Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest this evening is George Webb. George is an independent citizen, journalist, investigator who has been looking into well the Clinton emails, Podesta emails, and the Clinton Foundation. George, how are you doing this evening?
Great, Tim. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. And well, I mean, you've been doing. I've been watching the series of videos that you've posted. There's been some important developments recently regarding Eric Braverman. Where is Eric Braverman, and who killed Monica Peterson? What you've uncovered is a complex story of the inner workings of the Clinton Foundation and how it has been involved in. Well, I can be fairly described as a criminal enterprise. But apparently, what you've uncovered is sort of a criminal. Political network of various evildoers, yes, you could say, who make their money off fomenting wars, creating mayhem, and then buying resources on the cheap. Is that a fair description of what's going on here?
It's a fair description. There is one little twist here in that the original MENA airport that Clinton set up to start the whole thing off, which was basically Iran-Contra, if people remember that, is flying guns down to the Contras in Nicaragua and flying drugs back to MENA, Arkansas, to pay for it. And that was set up by George Bush and Ali North. So if under the banner of national security. So I truly believe to this day that all these machinations up till now have just been a kind of a replay of the MENA airport operation, if you will. And to this day, I believe Hillary believes she's doing this in the interest of national security. So a lot of people, say this is evil and terrible and horrible and so forth, and I have this kind of alternate theory that she truly believes when she goes to bed at night that it's national security that is why she's doing it.
So it's kind of like, I guess you could say, she's sort of a crackpot realist, I guess you could say.
Well, in the same way that Queen Elizabeth would have said, "Well, I need a spy network, and there's all these Catholics that have infiltrated us, and we need to get rid of them all, and we need to have these events that are contrived to like the gunpowder plot to get the population riled up to go after the Catholics." You know, that same sort of kind of self-delusion, I guess.
Sort of, I guess you could say the reason for of state excuse, sort of a state security,
Exactly.
that old saw. Well, okay. Well, you've started this research, I guess, sometime around was it October, November, and
October.
so it's a complex story, and it involves gun running, narcotics trafficking, a lot of intrigue, human trafficking, and possibly organ harvesting. Pretty sinister stuff. And how do you want to introduce your research in this area? What's the best way to go?
Well, what I do is I call it storyboarding. I had a long conversation today with Cy Hirsch, and he's the guy who broke the My Lai massacre and the CIA and FBI spying on, Vietnam protesters and all that sort of thing. And, he basically said, "I'm a print guy. I'm a print journalist." And what YouTube has allowed is to take that journalism, which was kind of like a book journalism, every 2 years I come out with a book, to this more what I call open media research, which is there's so many, it's kind of like having the New York Times, but it's an open source New York Times. It's crowdsourced New York Times. So I write an article, and then I have these contributors come back to me with all the supporting documentation sources and citations. And they say, "That's right." So if I say, "Well, I believe there's organ harvesting going on in, let's say, the central part of Haiti," I'll get 50, or not 50 sometimes, I'll just get 10, but I'll get a lot of sources and citations that come back that support that. So it's this ever-building case, ever, it's like a huge legal team, doing all this research, developing this case, and it's kind of a juggernaut in that sense. And it's not me. I'm just a stenographer. I always say that. It's these researchers who have so much in-depth insight and knowledge, And all I do is try to iteratively tell their story and summarize their story and storyboard what they do, what they say. And like I said, I'm a stenographer, I'm a storyboarder. And it's an amazing, I think it's an amazing new form of journalism.
So you're kind of aggregating the information, putting it all together, and presenting a narrative based on the evidence that you've been given.
Yeah, and the analogy would be if I was given a script of a movie, you know, it would take me, you know, maybe 4 or 5 hours to read the script if I'm an actor or whatever. But if I see a movie poster and I see the 5 actors and it says a couple of key lines, I get the gist of the movie, you know, oh, Casablanca, you know, man lost, you know, in Africa, you know, trying to find his soul. You know, here's the beautiful woman. Here's the guy trying to get him his immigration papers. And there's the other guy trying to stop him, you know. You get quickly, you know, at a glance what the gist of it is rather without having to read the whole thing. And so the, so that's what I try to do. Now, it's not that the supporting script isn't there behind the movie poster. It is. It is for every slide in my presentation. But it's a in terms of understanding the news, it's a much better way of understanding these relationships rather than, you know, just being told it's the Russians, you know, ad nauseum, you know, for 2 weeks. And you really don't get any additional understanding of what's actually going on.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, you started the series, Where is Eric Braverman? Apparently he has appeared.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So he's rematerialized and he, he's back on the scene. I think he's working for the Google. Is it the Google Eric Schmidt Foundation? Is that Google?
Yep.
Okay, mm-hmm. So working at another foundation. Okay, he's a foundation guy. Okay. Now I think anyone familiar with the deep state and the intrigues of the ruling elite know how foundations can be used and abused to further their interests at the expense of humanity, under the cover of philanthropy and charity. That's been the modus operandi at least since the early 20th century. But this is the Clinton Foundation is a particularly egregious case here because the corruption is so blatant. It's you pay for play, people die, some people dying mysteriously. Well, I guess the best way to go is Eric Braverman. What's his story? How did this all begin?
Well, it began with him kind of going to the press and saying, you know, this is, I think it was the King of Morocco giving Hillary a you know, what amounted to $26 million bribe. His bribe was $12 million, but then there was a phosphate king of Morocco that also gave $60 million. So it amounted to a $28 million bribe. Well, the King of Morocco's history of human rights is just absolutely the worst. It's just off the charts, you know, decapitations. If you even say anything against the king, 10 years in prison. He's occupied Western Sahara, particularly depopulated the whole Western Sahara to put an oil pipeline and drilling and an LNG port in. You know, so it's just one of those things that Braverman, teaching at the Jackson School of Business at Yale, a course called Ethics in Government, you know, I think it was just like, I cannot do this anymore. I'm gone. And I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back for Braverman. He just said, I cannot do this anymore. And the Clinton Foundation had a huge confab in Morocco because of that donation to try to give legitimacy to the King of Morocco for the takeover of Western Sahara. And he just said, I just can't be a part of this.
And of course, all this was occurring when Clinton was presiding as Secretary of State.
Well, the King of Morocco deal was a little bit later.
Okay.
Braverman comes in. So Braverman starts in this story when she is Secretary of State, and he sets up this Haiti Relief Fund when the earthquake happens at the first part of January of 2010. And so the Haiti thing happens. Then the Libya 2011, just generally here. Syria is 2012, and then Braverman comes in 2013. Braverman really comes in because Hillary's no longer in the State Department, so they need kind of a social justice cover, I guess is what I call it, to, you know, keep getting donations. So, you know, Braverman didn't just join the story in 2013. He goes all the way back to 2010.
Okay. And well, here we have so he, but then he's apparently in some of these WikiLeaks emails that were released, he is named as a possible source by John Podesta.
Yes, he is.
Okay.
I think it's the March 9th, 2015 email. What people at the Clinton Foundation don't realize, and the enemies of Hillary and Bill Clinton don't realize, is they have very strong friends in the FBI. And you know the Edward Snowden disclosures, where there's this dragnet sweeping of all phone calls and so forth. That has been going on since 1998, and even earlier with just wiretaps. But all of her political opponents and the people who work for her are under surveillance. So it was a very quick, what they call a deep dive surveillance, to go through all the people who worked at. Once they saw the article come out, the Ron Fournier article come out, they did a deep dive. Andrew McCabe, the assistant director of the FBI, did a deep dive and found out it was Eric Braverman.
Okay,
And
interesting.
so Braverman then is kind of on the run at that point, you know.
And Andrew McCabe is the recipient of, didn't he get like a $675,000, or his wife did, who was running for political office?
Yeah,
Did I
his
get that
wife.
right?
Yes, his wife was running for a very minor office, and they had one hot dog fry, and they put T-shirts on, and they took the picture. But for most intents and purposes, they bought their house in Virginia, and
And who's the governor of Virginia?
Terry McAuliffe, who's been a 30-year friend of Bill Clinton's, and even McAuliffe, if you meet him at parties and so forth, he says, "Yeah, I'm the bag man for Bill Clinton." I mean, it's that obvious, you know. It's like, if Bill needs a check written, I carry his checkbook. So, and again, I don't want to, attack or anything the Clintons necessarily, other than I think the deep state that you mentioned, Tim, is really what's at play here. You know, it's Kissinger, it's the Council on Foreign Relations that are kind of the guiding hand, and then Hillary's kind of the implementer, or George Bush was the implementer, or whoever is kind of the implementer of those policies, you know.
As she said, when I think when she was commemorating, CFR had opened up an office in Washington, D.C., and she said that now she doesn't have to go to New York to get her orders. When she was.
That's very true.
Yeah, I
Few
don't think.
moments.
Yeah, she laughed when she said it, but I don't think she was joking. I think it's all very true.
No,
History of
it's
the
all
Council
very
of Foreign
true.
Relations, yes.
Yep.
Okay, so in these several of videos that you put up, you outline a few of the, well, this whether it's an the rat line out of Libya into Syria, the arms shipments, the arm narcotics trafficking, the arms illegal arms sh shipments to foment civil wars in order to secure pipelines and disrupt, I guess you could say, certain countries, and also. It also allows for a very sinister yet lucrative human trafficking network. So where does revolution, civil war, arms shipments, narcotics trafficking, and human trafficking, how do they all intersect? Is it all part of the CFR, or is it Kissinger? Is it what's going on here?
Well, there's an economic layer, and the economic strategists at that higher layer, the Bravermans and the Neil Browns. Neil Brown is at KKNR, and he's married to Eric Braverman. So these are kind of like I call them Kissinger's kids. They're deeply trained in petroleum, or water pipelines, and all these issues of the World Bank and USAID. And they're groomed. These are the stars. You know, Bill Clinton was that person. Barack Obama was that person. You know, they're counsel on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and so forth. Those folks don't really like to dirty their hands with worrying about all this. You know, I drew the pipeline on the map, and it's a beautiful line, and I really don't want to know how the actual pipe gets laid. I don't want to know about sarin gas clearing the tribes and all the machinations and chicanery that goes on to make this stuff happen. And so they kind of are in the clouds. You know, this is kind of this elite that everybody talks about. You know, they're all Ivy League, and they have these nice dinners and stuff and parties at the Council on Foreign Relations. And then there's this other layer, which is kind of the David Petraeus layer. He's also at KKNR, but he's the war planner. And he goes out and gets guys like General Grange, who is an ex-Delta Force, you know, Vietnam, Phoenix program. You know, we're going to fly the tanks in here on the helicopters. We're going to do this. You know, the Delta Force is going to come in there, and we're going to slice all these throats, and then we're going to laser target these things and blow these things up, you know. So there's this kind of, you know, layer, like insulating shade between the two layers that happen. And in my videos, I ask, does Braverman and Brown know that all this stuff happens? Do they know that, you know, the ISIS has used sarin gas 52 times, you know, to clear land for a rat line and a pipeline, you know, those kind of questions. And I really don't know the answer still to this day. You know, 88 days in, I still don't know.
So the Clinton Foundation is more just, it's a facility that's being used by these corrupt interests, the deep state, the financial elite, the financial interests, both the oil companies or Wall Street. And that might explain why, despite the Clinton Foundation's problems with its paperwork, its legal problems that have been detailed by Charles Ortel, there's been no investigation or effort to shut it down or to prosecute what is clearly fraud being committed at the Clinton Foundation. Is that a fair, is that a reasonable suspicion?
Yeah, but if you take my slightly alternate view, that consider the Clinton Foundation like the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation as a funnel to fund covert operations overseas, okay? Let's just say that they are using the Clinton Foundation in the same way. Then Hillary is saying to herself, hey, I'm just executing. I'm just a funnel to execute foreign policy. It's not really me doing these bad things. It's these people at Council of Foreign Relations making these decisions. I'm just executing them. I'm just a better executor of the decisions than, you know, somebody else. So, you know, most of the folks on my site are, you know, Hillary's evil, Hillary's evil. And I try to present a picture of this guiding hand of Kissinger, you know, telling her kind of like, oh, let's try this here. Let's do that there. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah. It would kind of be the equivalent of blaming Clinton for the MENA Arkansas operation when he was simply doing the bidding of higher powers at the time.
Yeah. If you look at the whole situation, you know, Robert Rubin, who was later was Clinton's Treasury Secretary, he was at Goldman Sachs. He let out a whole bunch of bonds on the market for the Arkansas Development Financing Authority. And, you know, all these people, they don't know, you know, everybody's, you know, municipal bonds is a great deal. You know, you get a little bit higher return. Let's buy them. Who knows what they're doing in Arkansas? Well, this money would come in at, you know, $100 million a month. So Hillary at the Rose Law Firm said, okay, look, anybody here who wants $1 million, you just need to pay me a $50,000 fee, consulting fee to the Rose Law Firm, and I'll give you $1 million. You'll never have to repay your loan. So that's how the whole operation started. And, you know, they had 12 years of that, and you would think that would be good money, you know, and this is the whole junk bond thing where everything crashed later on. Mm-hmm. But then they added this MENA airport thing, and that was also $100 million a month. So what you had, you couldn't put $100 million in Hillary's account or Bill's account because it would be an obvious money laundering. They needed an account that could look realistic, that would fill up to $100 million. And at the end of the month, the 31st day, they'd sweep it out to 10 offshore accounts, get it back down to zero, and let it grow back up. And that same kind of, you know, whisk it out at the end of the month is used in Haiti. And the only thing you change is, instead of the Arkansas Development Finance Authority, is you just change the name to World Bank. And USAID is what's giving them the money. So the Clintons have this repeating pattern that you just see over and over. It's just like if you see some of these old movies done by, you know, the horror movies that are really kind of cheap and cheesy. Mm-hmm. And then you see another one, you go, I know that movie. I know who did that.
Yes,
it's somebody. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, it's all very formulaic, what you're saying.
It's formulaic. And the Clintons are just, it's just, you can see it from a mile away.
Yet there's no effort ever to really investigate it or prosecute the wrongdoing because the people who they're working for are too big to jail, more or less. They're the powers that be. So you're not going to get an honest investigation into these things.
If you look at Andrew McCabe, every time he's tried to shut the investigation down or carve it up into five little pieces or six little pieces or wall it off, he's gotten promoted. So, and if you look at James Comey during this whole cycle, this all goes back to, oh, by the way, the money that $100 million that the Clinton found, that they were making at Arkansas Development Finance Corporation was going into two banks. One was in Georgia, the other was in Florida, and that was BCCI. That was being transferred to BCCI, which was Mark Rich's bank. So, of course, Bill Clinton pardons Mark Rich 18 years later. You know, and we're still running Mark Rich type operations. You just changed the bank name from BCCI to HSBC. I mean, they almost don't even want to use new letters. It's still a four-letter bank, and you only add one or two new letters. It's such a sparse, you know, attempt to cover things up.
Yeah, and one of Bill Clinton's benefactors in Arkansas when he was running for president in 1992 was Jackson Stevens, who brokered the arrival of BCCI. So there's another connection there. Yeah. And that was that Georgia bank. Was that Burt Lance's bank, if I recall? Carter's?
I think that's right. Yeah, Burt Lance.
Yeah, Burt Lance. And that was a mini scandal. But that's one of those scandals that were shut down. Never really went to the bottom. Because BCCI, I guess, was critical in the 80s because it helped finance a lot of the operations. You know, Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan was a Pakistani bank that inevitably collapsed. When it collapsed, you know, brought down, you know, I think he was retired at the time, but it exposed the criminal machinations of Clark Clifford, this old, you know, this Washington, D.C., you know, mainstay and a power broker who helped write the National Security Act, which formed the CIA, a banker.
I was just going to say, Clark Clifford goes all the way back to the birth of the CIA.
And that's the picture right there. What we're dealing with, this level of corruption is so deep. I mean, it goes to all the way to the top and then back to the CFR, because, of course, the Council of Foreign Relations, you could argue, they're the ones that came up with the idea of the Central Intelligence Agency, because they wanted to formalize these incestuous relationships that Wall Street had with Washington, you know, for decades, in the early part of the 20th century with the Spanish-American War and the Rockefellers and National City Bank and all that stuff. So it's kind of a consummation of this incestuous relationship when the CIA was created in 47, 48. But the career of Clark Clifford is a good illustration of how this works. Yeah, no, that's true.
You know, and what I love about history and your command, Tim, of the history is so good, is that you pick out just one person in this, and if you present the whole, you know, galaxy of people that are involved, it just overwhelms you in complexity. But if you take somebody like that, Clark Clifford, who really wrote the whole plan, and you say Clark Clifford is the one who put Kissinger in Vietnam from his papers in Harvard in 1965 to run Operation Mongoose, to run, you know, heroin from Laos over to the DMZ zone, mm-hmm. and get GIs hooked on heroin to make money, you know, so Israel would survive. I'm a moderate Zionist, I have to warn you. So I sometimes I have a little bit of, like, you know, you'll have a little pride coming out. I'm not saying there's pride in getting GIs hooked on heroin. But, I mean, that gives you I compare it to a submarine, you know. If you're in a fishing village and all of a sudden a nuclear submarine, you know, the Trident submarine comes up and surfaces beside you, and you've never seen, you know, you've never been to, you know, had television or anything, you're freaked out of your mind, right? And that is what I try to do is – in my pieces, this whole covert underground or underwater infrastructure of these covert operations. I try to slowly bring that submarine to the surface to not freak everybody out. It doesn't mean that that submarine doesn't exist. It doesn't mean there isn't nuclear submarines in the world. It just means that you have to, in as a citizen journalist, just slowly show the layers so people go, oh, that's the conning tower. Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. And so people just don't get overwhelmed. And that's what I love about the Clark Clifford story, because it really shows the slow development of the CIA into these covert operations, where they start thinking, hey, we can run this operation over here without the knowledge of the president. We can come in when the operation's over, like, let's say, the Guatemala coup in 1954, and just have a paper to say how it turned out and give it to the president, Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how it I really believe the Arbenz coup in 54 is really when they said, hey, this is our independent operation. And then Kennedy said, I'm going to break into 1,000 pieces. That didn't turn out so far. You know, the CIA, I'm going to break into 1,000 pieces. That didn't turn out well for Kennedy. And the only other blip in this on the radar was the Church Commission. And he died at 56 of cancer. And from then on, it was wheels up. You know, the CIA has really been untouched. And now Trump says he wants to do reform. So this is really the third inflection point since Clark Clifford wrote those original papers to get the National Security Act passed.
And this is where we get into the sex angle, because blackmail is a big part of controlling the political process, neutering over meaningful oversight, and also it is also a source of a lot of, like drugs, it's a source of black off-budget money to operate, have these operations. I mean, huge proceeds will go to fund these operations that are off the books, so they don't have to answer difficult questions in these things. This is where some of these banking scandals intersect with some of the sex scandals, like the Franklin scandal, because, of course, the Franklin Credit Union was implicated in Iran-Contra. And the same thing, there was a book written back in 1992, I think, 91, by Peter Bruton. He was a reporter for the Houston Post, I think, who had a book deal squashed from a major publisher. He had to do it from a smaller publisher, called The CIA, George Bush, and the Mafia, about some of the, particularly in Texas, in the late 60s, 70s, and early 80s. And the savings and loan scandal and debacle was largely precipitated by these banks being pilfered by organized crime and the CIA to carry out these criminal operations. Much of it was the Central American thing with the Contra. So you could look at a lot of these savings and loans as little mini BCCCIs all over the country being pilfered.
Yeah.
And then the taxpayers left.
Well, just like the Arkansas Development Finance Authority,
yeah.
You basically just give out loans for bribes, and then you crash the financial institution when it can't support itself anymore. But I do want to say one thing, and this is kind of interesting. I'm always kind of sticking up for the CIA, and people don't like it. But if you watch the career of Alan Dulles, he's always imitating what the KGB is doing. The KGB gets the slip on him, but it's because he's got 10 to 50 times more resources than the USSR, he always overdoes it in the other way. And you said the sex angle. The Stalin and then Khrushchev have this Natasha program. And this Natasha program is, you know, they make fun of it on the Boris and Natasha with the cartoon, the Bullwinkle thing. But these Natashas are, I guess the first one would have been the one that got the Enigma machine from the Polish scientist, the Polish mathematician, with the, making love on the tiger thing in front of the fire, the hearth, but they train these women to like speak 12 languages and know all this about all these political circles and so forth. And because they had no resources, they had women, but they didn't have the resources to do all the covert operations and the flying of the planes and the cashing of the weapons and all that stuff. Whereas the Dulles brothers were more into the Gladio type thing, where, you know, we're going to fly the people in, we're going to put the weapons all over, and then we're going to, you know, have a revolution one day. Well, they found out that all these guys, you know, the head of the NATO and the head of, you know, the German, every country in NATO was compromised by these Natashas. And they joked that they knew what was happening before their subordinates did, you know, because they would have happened the night before, you know. So that's where Alan Dulles goes into this MKUltra, where he says, we've got to have a similar capability. They don't quite have the know-how to cultivate a woman who was willing to do that for her country. So, you know, maybe Valerie Plame might be the only person that came close to that. But they say, drugs, you know, if we drug them, you know, so there's all this money spent on MKUltra to, you know, with the drugs and using the women to...
This is a George Hunter White in Operation Midnight Climax and these things?
Midnight Climax was one of the first ones, and that's where they started with these brownstone operations. Midnight Climax was one of the first ones, and all MK Ultra was how to use drugs, you know, developed in Montreal, that at McGill, and Frank Olson was the guy who came up with an aerosol form of fentanyl. He came up with an aerosol form of propofol, and all that whole. So everyone thinks, oh, George Bush is a horrible person because he did Franklin scandal. I think he was just kind of running with the Alan Dulles playbook. You know, this is how it's done. We go into a country, we compromise everybody, we get everybody on film, and then we do business, you know.
Now, when you say brownstone operation, I guess that's referring to a brownstone mansion or townhouse where you have parties, right? This is sort of like a manual or a model that the intelligence services have, particularly CIA has. I think you described it as how someone can, with $10,000, can go into a country, and if he follows this plan, within a decade, he can have control of the political system in that country.
Yeah, what I do is that, you know, and these were run by Jeff Epstein in New York, and I've reported on it way back in 2003, I gave a lot of information to Paul Rodriguez of the Washington Times about it at that time. He never ran the story. But basically, you come to the party. It's all the top people. Trump would come to these parties. He'd be there for like 5 minutes. He'd have some new model. He'd shake a hand. He'd get his picture taken by 50 reporters, and then he would leave. But the party has a beginning and a middle and an end. Middle is the... you know, everybody glad handing and picture taking, and then there's the hors d'oeuvres in the middle, and then the waitresses come out in lascivious clothing, and both men and women, and the people that are offended leave, and then the targets are left over, and they're all filmed. I mean, I'm talking 12 cameras, low light, every possible angle you can think of. And then they always have a teddy bear or some kind of weird art. You see this in the Podesta thing. There's always this weird art. And Jeffrey Epstein's places all had weird art. You just, right before a major vote in the Congress, like NDAA, you send them a picture of the teddy bear. You send them a picture of the weird art.
Or Obamacare, right?
Or Obamacare.
When the Supreme Court is about to render a decision, right? That's been the rumor. Yeah.
Yeah, it works for judges too. Yeah,
yeah, that's very similar to what was described with by both Henry Vincent and Nick Bryant regarding the Franklin scandal. Craig Spence's operation in Washington D.C. seems to be a brownstone operation.
Yep, Barney Frank went. Craig Spence was a CIA guy, but yeah. Barney Frank went, ran one D.C. Madam one, D.C. Madam two. Jack Ramsey's ran one in Boulder, the second mile with what's his name? Sandusky was one.
And that's another investigation that was quashed, shut down.
Yeah.
And it's also it's also very similar to the Marc Dutroux affair in Belgium, which probably is a NATO operation, right?
All those NATO operations were run by Tyler Drumheller, who was with Sid Blumenthal and Osprey Global, General Grange. All those operations was Valerie. Now, Valerie, I want to say something about Valerie Plame. She wasn't just the sex kitten or whatever. She didn't really know too much. She knew the generals were being compromised, but she was getting them to the party, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of innuendo and teasing, and then there were other, you know, girls that were being used to, you know, get them on film.
Yeah, most people know her through her work with the CIA front Brewster Jennings and her efforts supposedly in counterproliferation, or there's probably more intrigue to that too. But you're saying she was involved in compromising foreign, you know, political officials, the military men.
Early days, the early 90s she was what was known. She did the Brownstone stuff, and then she was brought back to Washington, and she went through this extensive training, which is called a non-official covert officer, or it's called a NOC. And I mean, they go through a year of intensive training where you have, you know, all these different people training you in French and the oil business and everything, so that when you walk into a major oil conference, which is what they retrained her to do, you know everything. You speak, you know, and plus she's a very beautiful woman and so forth. So she goes back to Europe and goes back to Turkey and Iraq and becomes this kind of super spy. And her husband, Joe Wilson, is also a NOC. He's quite a bit older, I think 13, 14 years older. And he was the original, they're economic spies, basically.
Yeah.
They're economic spies.
And this sort of, yeah, economic or corporate espionage is I would say it's probably more in tune with the CIA's real mission than opposed to this sort of this state-to-state espionage stuff, because the CIA has always been it's a corporatist intelligence agency. It's there to do the bidding of multinational corporations, the Anglo-American corporations, the banking, Western banking interests, and things like that. So it's not there to fight Ruskies or to fight bad guys. It's there to engage in these sort of things. And this involves, well, the big thing, like I said, this involves some of these sex traps, which is why when we hear some of these stories, some of these salacious reports, whether it's the so-called Pizzagate scandal, or you know the call boy thing in the late 80s in the White House with the Reagan Bush administration, these things are all intelligence operations, blackmail, and it's bribery and blackmail. Yeah. So.
I always say when you're talking about economic spying versus state spying, I think there's a balance there, and I think it changes over time. I think it's about 70, like you said, 70% economic spying, about 30% national security, because it's kind of like one hand washes the other.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it goes 60-40, but it's always tilted, I would agree with you, in the economic spying more often. But yeah, so all these ritual things and so forth that they talk about with the satanic and so forth, that's just to get the useful pawns to do what you want them to do. But at the higher levels, they're not satanic and whatnot. They're running an operation. And like Bohemian Grove, you know, you saw the, you know, General Powell saying, hey, you can come to Bohemian Grove, you know, and you get there. And it's a kind of a 3-week indoctrination process to get people to the final where, you know, there's a mock execution of, you know, some sex slave, you know.
Yeah.
I don't really think they kill the sex slave. I think, but everyone there thinks he's been killed. So now you're bound, you know, to secrecy, you know, when the NDAA vote comes up, you know.
Yeah, and there's always been an exploitation of satanic groups and cults by intelligence agencies, because these are assets that the agencies can use to run drugs, to do a lot of the dirty stuff. At the same time, the agencies can keep an arm's length from them. I think that was suggested by FBI agent Ted Gunderson regarding the Jeffrey McDonald case.
Because
that was I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, the jury's still out in my mind whether Jeffrey McDonald was guilty or not. His family certainly wasn't guilty, and they killed their whole family, his whole family. and they were trying to develop that helter skelter meme. So yeah. Anytime they had one of these operations go wrong, the cleaner, you know, the Harvey Keitel type cleaner is a, what, we got to come up with something. Well, we can do mass shooter. No, let's not do mass shooter. Let's do cult killers. Okay. Let's do cult killers. And I call it the blood on the wall. They have to write something in blood on the wall. So the press, you know, reports on that. And these are just memes, you know, that they come up with, you know, to clean. It's a cleaning operation when they're done.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey McDonald certainly was if the Jeffrey McDonald case was, I mean, if people don't know, I mean, there was dead GIs. This is horrible for families that have lost somebody as a GI, but they were putting, drugs, cocaine and heroin, excuse me, into the body cavities of dead soldiers. And then in these body bags, you know, people, when they see that come through on the aircraft and so forth, they don't inspect that. They have a respect for the dead GI. And so they were coming into Fort Bragg, and they had this kind of satanic cult, like you mentioned, that was pulling these, vials of heroin. And it was a big sex traffic, not sex traffic, a drug traffic operation at Fort Bragg. And the only question I still don't know is, did Jeff know about it or didn't he?
Yeah. And that's another angle there. No, another example is the Finders case, where another cult, a sex cult, was apparently exploiting children, was exposed in Florida. The investigation led up to Washington, D.C. There is an office and a warehouse with all types of state-of-the-art telecommunication equipment, also mixed with satanic paraphernalia, pedophilia, and it was quashed under the excuse of national security by the Central Intelligence Agency, which suggests that this is another one of these, procuring programs, blackmail and stuff. And it's an example of the agency using a cult to do the dirty work to deliver the bodies where they want to be. That's some, a lot of evidence to suggest that was going on with the Finders case. The big tell is when it's shut down under the reasons of national security.
Yeah.
And that's the big tell. I mean, that's, and it appears that's all same thing with the Franken scandal where, the accusers went to jail for perjury because she didn't recant. And then many people turned up dead, like Gary Caradore, the chief investigator, prosecutor who was plane bloop in midair. the evidence went missing. These things, these are tell that the higher ups are, this involves higher ups, and they've obviously called out the jackals to tidy things up a bit. In your talk, you detail, you get the impression that certain interests are making a lot of money off mayhem, national disasters, civil wars. You focus on Haiti. We can look at Libya and Syria. In Syria, both Syria and Haiti, according to your investigations, are a big part of this human trafficking and organ harvesting. Do you want to get us some details of what you? Because that's particularly disturbing. But somehow, the problem here is that war and suffering has become a profit center from a class of people who look at humanity as livestock to be harvested. That's what it looks like to me. Do you want to get into some of the details here?
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head, Tim. I mean, it's if you look at Haiti, it's divided into three parts. There's the part to the north, which is kind of the not very populated, and then there's the middle, which is even less populated, which is kind of the there's three mountain ranges. So two big mountain ranges that makes the three parts of Haiti. And Haiti's the big horseshoe, you see on the maps. The middle part is hardly any population at all, and then most of the population is down in the south by Port-au-Prince. Okay, just to give your listeners a sense. And the what's happening in Haiti is the wealthy class, the kind of the ruling class, is all the USAID money, all the Clinton Foundation, and all the State Department money went into the north part of Haiti. They built a new international airport. They built a huge new container shipping center. oil shipping dock. They're building another one for the commercial class over in Cape Hatien. They built also a prison, but the State Department built a prison for them. They also built, you know, this new university. And it's all way, way, way far away from where the epicenter of the earthquake was. So you'd think, you know, all this aid money going into Haiti, but nobody reported it. And it all went into the center of Haiti, or in the north of Haiti. Down in the south, the only thing they built was a hotel, a big hotel. And it hosted this company called Digicel. And Digicel, if people don't know, is, I think, an 88% monopoly of Haitians because they gave away the cell phone. They were through USAID, and they have this application on there for microfinancing. Well, microfinancing sounds good. It's the mother who wants to get a sewing machine so that she can put her kids through college rather than working at the sweatshop all day. Well, it turns out that the interest, it's worse than payday loans. It goes up to 195%. So you actually have people getting their kidneys, giving a kidney, because you live on one, to pay the interest on their loans. And this goes all the way back to this guy named Eunice in 1974. And you're going to find Carlos Slim with his Telcel monopoly of South America and Central America and the Caribbean is also doing microfinancing loans. Every time you get into this kidney for paying interest, you know, this, I call it micro sharking, like for microfinance loan sharking. As soon as you see micro sharking, the next thing you see is organ harvesting. And what I mean by that is in the central part, so what's happening in Haiti is the rich are up in the north, the poor are in the south, and this middle area is where you put your UN peacekeepers. It's your neutral area. And that's where you're going to see your forced vaccinations for clinical trials for drugs. So, you know, in Haiti, for instance, that's where the original clinical trials were for the birth control pills and then Depo-Provera, and just every drug that's used in the United States is first, you know, trialed in Haiti. And this general who ran the invasion of Libya is one of the people that's also on this board of this drug company doing these clinical trials, this General Grange. So when you bring in these peacekeepers from Nepal, you know, they don't speak the language. They're there. The way you make the soldiers happy is you give them the sex trade. So there's a lot of sexual trafficking. They end up doing a lot of experimentation with these drug trials to see what the toxicity levels are. So then you have people dying from that. They harvest the organs from the people who die in the drug trials. So their liver, their kidneys may be shot, their livers may be shot from the overdrugging, but their hearts are still okay. So you see this kind of organ harvesting going on from these drug trials gone wrong, and you see the same thing in conflict zones. And this corporation that teaches these police that all around the world called DynCorp, DynCorp, is running these operations all around the world. And it's kind of a play on words like dying corpse, you know, dying corp.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, and it's almost like a CIA wink. I mean, DynCorp is the CIA. It's just this front organization to teach these UN peacekeepers to come in as police and run these sex trafficking operations. So in Syria, for instance, this can be the White Helmets.
Yes.
They get kids out of the dust. The CNN takes their picture and puts them on the ambulance or whatever. And the cute kids go to UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, to princes' houses to be six-year-old brides.
And the important thing is you have to have a country that's been destabilized, that's been fractured by war, civil war, been bombed out. The people are desperate. So it's easy to exploit them because they have very little choice. Their options are very narrow at that point. And also, if you kill off their family, you have a bunch of orphans you can exploit.
And that MO or that pattern repeats itself over and over and over. You know, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya. There's a huge sex trafficking or child exploitation through Malta. And the way it works is the models, you know, the beautiful of the beautiful get kind of, the cream gets kind of culled off the top. And those are the ones that go to Jeffrey Epstein's island in the Caribbean. Those are the ones that are kind of marketed to the elite of, you know, Europe and the elite of the United States. Then the rest, you know, go on for the, you know, the regular trafficking. And then there's this kind of like the way a barrel of oil is, you know, kind of refined is the same thing. It's the science of it has been refined down to, you know, here's the, you know, the cream goes here, the milk goes here, the chaff goes here.
Yeah. And well, I mean, if you look at these resource wars that, that are being waged, by the, by the Anglo American empire, I guess you could say the West, to extract resources on the cheap, by waging war, making the taxpayers pay for the war or the drug money pay for the war. Then the corporations come in and it's a way to socialize your risk and privatize your profits. That's what the Central Intelligence Agency really, and other intelligence agencies are really good for. They socialize the risk and make sure that the profits are privatized. But you're after the resources. You're after whether it's the rare earth metals, agricultural land, aquifers, natural gas, petroleum, whatever. Of course, the ultimate resource is human resource. That's a disturbing term, but it's true, human resource. And they look at it as a human resource. That's a sort of a technocratic term. It's I mean, if you look throughout war, what do? In war, you kill the men and you sell the women and children off into slavery. You know, that goes back in your antiquity. It's just being continued today, just undercover of humanitarian intervention and, you know, peacekeeping and these things. It's war, nonetheless. But again, these people are, these human beings are there to be exploited and more or less whatever value or wealth they have that can be extracted. That could be through cheap labor, being forced into a sweatshop because you've been forced off your ancestral homelands, or you can be sold into the sex trade. And judging on what your physical attributes are, you're going to go to, you can be sold off at a higher price to go to the, end up at a, you know, whether what you look like will determine whether or not you go, you end up, you know, servicing a soldier in Haiti, working for the UN, or you end up at a Eyes Wide Shut party or something like that. Is that correct? Is that a good way to put it?
I think that's a great way to put it. And if you, I mean, I hate to put it in these terms, but if you go back to, I mean, Christopher Columbus first discovered Hispaniola, which is Haiti, and he first, you know, Africans were first brought to Haiti. And if you look at the American slave trade, it was exactly that. And that's how, I mean, I don't mean to speak in these crass terms because I know it's so hurtful to African Americans now, but I think they also would, you know, the scholars, you know, would say this is true, that the beautiful of the beautiful were first marketed and then the, you know, and they moved along, you know, as far as their, you know, their auction, you know, docket was concerned. And the same thing is happening. It's only under a social justice cover. You know, the if you look at the Clintons and how they handled this, they brought in Sean Penn. They brought in the model Nemcova, you know, the gal who was in the 2004 tsunami, who, you know, the story of holding onto the coconut tree as was swept away, which is, anyway, she's very close to the Clinton Foundation. And then they have her have a, you know, she's the, you know, one of the elite. And I think she's from one of the conflicts as well. I think she's from either the Bosnia or the Kosovo. So it's she ends up with the premier of Haiti. She first is with Sean Penn, but then she's later, you know, paired up with this guy from Haiti, this popular singer that Martelli is the American pronunciation. So they come in and they have this kind of celebrity social justice kind of panache, and the media just, you know, thousands of cameras because they're all beautiful people. And everyone thinks, well, they did great for Haiti, you know. And there's, and this is what Braverman, and this is why I kind of stick up for Braverman a little bit. He was going to be the guy who was going to go in and actually see, put in these, you know, procedures to actually see if the money actually got to where it should be. And, you know, if you talk to the people in Haiti right now, I mean, I talked to the lawyer of Aristide, you know, who was the, you know, the president of, or premier of Haiti, for prime minister of Haiti for three different times today. And, you know, all this week, she says, you know, 2% to 5% got through of the money that was given. Some people say it's as high as 10%, but I have never heard anybody say over 10% of the money donated got through. But people say, oh, Sean Penn was here, Nemcova was here, Martiyi, he's a great singer, he's a great dancer, he's the premier, president of this, who is a part of the Clinton Foundation. He's a movie maker. He owns Lionsgate Films, and Jeff Skoll is the
I'm sorry, you broke up. Skoll. Who was that? Was it Joyster or something? Joyster?
It's G-U-I-S-T-R-A. He's the owner or lead shareholder of Lionsgate Films.
They did the Hunger Games and things like that.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned the Hunger Games, because if you listen to Kathy O'Brien, who was a kind of a sex slave victim,
yes.
She talks of a very much like a Hunger Games scenario where she's naked and they give her a pair of shoes and then they say, start running. Mm-hmm. And then all these guys start running after her. You know, they give her whatever, a minute lead or whatever. And it's very much a Hunger Games scenario. If you look there's another movie that Lionsgate did called The Hostel, where there's, when they find a girl, they start bidding electronically amongst a bunch of brokers. And that's very chilling as well, because it's very chilling in the sense that that's the Malta. There's a kind of a Malta connection, that these Knights of Malta, it's a very small little island, but they can give away diplomatic passports, so you don't have to be intercepted when you travel internationally. And they have this little kind of bidding ring that they run. So it's very much like Eyes Wide Shut, as a matter of fact.
There's also, I think, the first Taken with Liam Neeson.
Taken.
Yeah.
Yep.
Was involving, I think this was Albanian human traffickers, I think, if I recall, from the movie.
Yep.
So, yeah. I mean, in Haiti itself, now there's been some suspicion that Haiti itself was targeted, even to the point that the earthquake itself was was manufactured.
Well, you're getting into the what people would call, conspiracy theory. But the idea of a peaceful nuclear explosion, or a PNE, and I'm not necessarily saying I believe in PNEs, but you look at the old Soviet Union, they had 725 of those during their oil exploration days. So it was quite common to put a deeply buried explosive device near a fault line and kind of set off the explosion to see what happened. You can Google PNE or, you know, and Wikipedia, and I'm not making this up. So if a nation is doing underground nuclear testing, you may as well do it near a fault line, because if you do and you release natural gas, you follow the gas bubbles, and you find oil.
Interesting.
This happened in India. So there's a couple of things that happened right before the earthquake in Haiti that are a little bit serendipitous, let's say. The person, Rajab Shah, at the age of 37 years old, is put in charge of USAID, which is kind of like the second position in the State Department. And 5 days before the earthquake, also the Bush-Clinton fund for Haiti is set up 5 days before the earthquake. And of course, Bill Clinton is the U.S. envoy to Haiti for the earthquake. So if you look at the plate, there's a Caribbean kind of sits on this plate, you know, between two fault lines.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't connect all the dots, but I'm just saying that if I was going to set off an underground explosion, I would do it in Haiti. Because Haiti has more oil than Venezuela. It's richer in oil than Venezuela is. So, and Venezuela is the richest country in South America and Central America in oil.
And what you'd want to do is, destabilize it even more to make sure that you can get control of those resources on the cheap, which just seems to be the economic model that's been in play for several decades, if not centuries.
If you look at what happened after the earthquake, it was like an invasion. It wasn't engineers from the UN coming in or agricultural experts. It was these helicopters, Delta Force, AK-47s.
Mm-hmm.
It was and all over the country. It wasn't just in the Port-au-Prince area. So, and they're still there. The UN peacekeepers are still there. You know, the coup was in 2004. So the peacekeepers are still, I think, at around 10,000 soldiers still there. 12 years later.
Now, I listened to a talk by Catherine Austin Fitz a while back.
Uh-huh.
And this idea of weaponized weather or weaponizing natural phenomenons, if you make something appear like a natural phenomenon, it's the best covert war you can wage against a country, a target country. And she said she was a financial planner, and she noticed that just before the tsunami that hit Indonesia in the Indian Ocean that back in 2004, December, mm-hmm. December 2004, that there was a shorting of Indonesian stock. I think Indonesia was the country, Indonesian stock, that indicated some foreknowledge of something major was going to happen.
Yeah.
And she said,
well, and they say they shorted airline stocks before 9/11 and
yeah,
all that.
It's creepy. And someone asked her about that. I said, well, she said, it's hard to do financial planning if we live in a world where a few men have the capacity to create, you know, natural disasters so they can short markets. But, weaponized weather, there is a UN treaty against it. So, and my assumption, if there's a treaty against it, it's broken.
So. Well, and so this is why the Kissingers of the world would want a rogue state, because rogue states don't have to play by the rules. You can say, oops, they...
Hello?
Oops, can you hear me?
Yeah, you cut out for a sec. Go ahead. You said oops.
Oh, sorry. Oops, we did another P&E, and we were doing a lot of secret drilling in the South China Sea. And I don't have drones, you know, Navy drones to do surveillance, so I can't state, you know, with, you know, total clarity that, you know, they're, you know, Kissinger's doing, you know, secret drilling in the South China Sea for China. I suspect it, but I can't really say that for sure. But I do know that the Clintons did do a lot of, you know, Hillary was behind the underground testing in India, offshore in India and near Sri Lanka, and then also the Sri Lanka testing, I believe, caused the Thai earthquake of 2004, the Christmas earthquake. And they always seem to do it on like a Christmas day or something. I don't know why that is.
If I recall, the tsunami was Christmas Day or Christmas Eve, wasn't it?
Yeah. The 2004. I think they do it because they want to have a lot of tourists there filming, and they want to have that tourist angle, and the people, the victims are all, you know, tourists, and here's their stories. And that's kind of like the human interest cover for the P&E. They just had one in Papua New Guinea on Christmas again. It's always Christmas, you know. they love to do it on Christmas when people are vacationing, I guess. But I really do believe, you know, Mark Rich did this. The reason why the Israelis got the nuclear capability so early was they were the, I believe the Israelis were, and this is coming from an Israeli, behind this, you know, that we were the PNE. There's a lot of explosions around South Africa near the South Pole where they create these, you know, there's this double flash that happens, you know, as the, I don't know why it creates a double flash, but the cloud collapses in on itself and then re-explodes. And it's a very distinctive signature. So when people see that double flash, I don't know, you know, what is it? I think it's a nuclear explosion, but I don't know. I can't prove it. Can't prove it. Yeah.
Hmm. So, I mean, so what we got here, again, you've, with your research, you've kind of, laid out this, it's almost like a lattice work of these interesting connections and connected events, various assassinations. You talked about, the death of Monica Peterson, which hasn't been explained yet. She wrote a thesis on human trafficking and she dies while she's in Haiti investigating this.
Yeah, I'm sorry. the conspiracy theories are fun to talk about, if nothing else. But back to brass tacks of the investigation, yes. So this gal goes down there. She's been to, I think she went to 22 different countries and in her doing her master's thesis, and she's 32 years old, and she's just quite the, you know, the writer. I've read a lot of the things she's read, and she goes to Haiti. I think she's been there a couple of times, and in January of last year, so this is about 12 months ago, she writes, "Wow, all this negative Clinton stuff. I'm here at this industrial park they built, and it seems more like, you know, a sex trafficking, you know, sweat sex shop. And I'm over here at this gold mine, and it seems like, you know, they're denuding the country of their resources." And she starts turning away from her kind of like training or her indoctrination that she was getting at this school at University of Denver. And she starts getting more into this, oh, this isn't really what it was. You know, it's kind of like, I'm not in Kansas anymore. This is really nasty stuff. And then there's this black hole of, we don't know anything after that, those March postings on social media. And most, you know, 32-year-olds, they're on Facebook all the time, especially if they're traveling to a different country. And they're, you know, taking selfies of themselves and so forth. We don't have her anything past a year ago. She's killed. Well, she supposedly commits suicide on November 13th last year. Hanging, but we don't have a police report. That's odd that no police report would be filed. It's odd that the Secretary of State or none of the people in the State Department would inquire to why is a 32-year-old who's very happy, who her parents think it's she was murdered, why they wouldn't at least inquire to get a police report. So there's a lot of questions. And so what I do in the series is really try to, you know, get public help, research help, to, you know, find out who killed Monica Peterson, you know?
So the official report, the official narrative is she committed suicide by hanging.
Yes.
Like Deborah Jean Palfrey, right? The DC Madam.
Yeah, same thing. Yeah. Same, you know, she hung herself, you know, the David Carradine thing, you know, it's just this kind of go-to when the, you know, the guys at the whiteboard,
yeah,
kind of forget or can't come up with something better. You know?
Now, this is pretty disturbing stuff, sinister stuff. What we're hearing about the not just the exploitation of people. You're talking about the literal harvesting. I mean, sex traffic is bad enough, especially when dealing with children. But then we're talking about you're creating conditions where you can harvest, literally harvest their organs for wealthier people, I presume. And I guess we're hearing this in America. We're thinking, well, this is horrible and all, but you know, this is what's going on abroad. They would never consider doing this to us, would they? They don't think of this this way. Well, perhaps they do. I mean, we had the case here where, I don't know, you're familiar with the case of Georgia State Senator Nancy Schaefer, and
Oh, sure.
yes, exposing the Child Protective Services. And there's, she tracked the money, followed the money, and that basically people being paid to take kids from families under the slightest pretext of neglect, putting them in foster care where they can be abused, drugged, and sold off. And of course, she commits suicide. Now, I'm sorry, her husband kills her and commits suicide. It's a murder suicide.
Yeah.
They both, because she's exposing this corruption, Child Protective Services. So, unless you think this is something that's only occurring in the outer reaches of the empire, it's occurring in this country too.
Yeah, I would encourage anybody to just, I mean, I have the Nancy Schaefer citations in my sources. So just listen to this woman for 5 minutes, or 3 minutes at a World Congress of Families or whatever, and she's just like this grandmother who cares, and she's saying, "No, the mother had a fight with the father one day at a barbecue about, not having enough hamburgers or something, just some slight little thing, and then CPS came in and just yanked the kids at first time having an issue and so forth, and just so happened the kids were beautiful, and they ended up being involved in all these, horrific things. And I think you're going to find there's going to be a lot of cases where people have gone crazy, like a Myron May, who was one of the he was the assistant district or assistant attorney general of Nevada or New Mexico. New Mexico. He's the one who blows the whistle on Jeff Epstein's Zorro Ranch. The Zorro Ranch is this big compound where Jeff Epstein's flying these DynCorp helicopters, and he's flying these Sinaloa guys to this remote ranch, and they're having all the sex trafficking. They're having these parties with El Chapo and everybody. And these people are targeted. These people who are whistleblowers are targeted in the U.S. with intimidation campaigns and surveillance and harassment, and so they basically can't take it anymore, around the clock, because they're exposing the stuff that's happening in the U.S.
They're gang stalked, and some suggest even they're subjected to some sort of electromagnetic, torture, or putting like voices in their
I don't
skull.
have any experience with the DEW stuff, the weapons, the electromagnetic. But from what I know of MK Ultra, where everything you would never have imagined was done, I don't disbelieve the people who say, "Oh, they don't like me. They came in and microwaved me." But I don't have any experience with that. But I do know that Hillary did, and Bill Clinton signed off on a memo that's called a Presidential Directive, Decision Directive. They call them PDDs, Presidential Decision Directive 62, which specifically calls for a disruption campaign like the old COINTELPRO. And it specifically states, I have this in my presentations, the CIA to give their best stuff to the FBI for the U.S. to disrupt targets in the U.S. And you say, well, that's really great if they're using it against terrorism targets. But no, they're using it against people who are calling out these abuses.
And we also have the well, another example of this human harvesting could be the prison, the privatized prison industrial complex, even just the prison industrial complex, because Clinton played a big part of that in his crime bill, both in Arkansas and as president, because under his presidency, the prison population exploded. At the same time, under the guise of the drug war, at the same time that these prisons were being privatized, and a lot of these corporations, like the Corrections Corporation of America, in their prospectus, require like a 90 to 95% occupancy rate in their contracts with the states. And what happens is, what ordinarily, if it was being run by the state, you're talking $15,000 to $20,000 a year per inmate. But they have these contracts that are spending $100,000 a year per inmate. So it's a huge wealth transfer. It's just like, why do we have $6 trillion missing at the Pentagon? Why does the F-35 cost $1 trillion? This money's being funneled off somewhere. It's going somewhere. It's embezzlement. But the sinister thing here is you have these the guys of law enforcement, drug sweeps. They go into poor neighborhoods, black neighborhoods usually, and sweep people up. And these people can't afford legal counsel. And they plea out, and they're in prison. And once they're in prison, well, one thing, their warm bodies create profit for these corporations. At the same time, their labor is sold. A lot of them are put to work, producing Kevlar equipment for the army and stuff like that. And they're being paid nickels a day when the company itself is making $100 a day off these people's labor. And this is all like a business model. But it's the same principle, wouldn't you agree? That's being operating.
Oh, absolutely. One of the best statistics I ever heard to compare what has changed in the same family. So George H.W. Bush does the Gulf War I, and the ratio of soldiers to contractors is 33-1. So a few contractors.
Mm-hmm.
David Petraeus is running Gulf War II, the contractor to soldier ratio goes to 1-1.
Hmm.
And then toward the end of the conflict, it goes to like 3-1, where there's 150,000 contractors there still, and there's only, 50,000 soldiers. And that, I love comparisons like that because it's just in the same family. You go from George Bush, the dad, to George Bush, the son. That whole privatization of war, prisons, domestic surveillance, domestic harassment, the whole criminal justice system with contractors, the intelligence community with the intelligence community is mostly, I think, about 65% private contractors, Booz Allen, so forth, security services, G4S, DynCorp, mm-hmm. Serco, all these names. And, if Trump did one thing, it would be just to say, okay, all contracts are off right now, and you're going to have to rebid everything and come to me with a proposal and let's just talk about this again, because what are we doing? Because if I'm paying a guard at a cross gate, the contractors are not just serving meals and doing the things. That was the whole idea. They were going to do the stuff in the background and we were going to have more people at the tip of the spear. That was the original Donald Rumsfeld argument for, contracting. No, these guys are, a guard at a checkpoint, I can pay that 18 or 19 year old guy from Nebraska, $20,000. And instead of a Blackwater guy at 80,000.
Mm-hmm.
And if the number one thing Trump could do right off the bat, is just say, okay, no contractors for right now. Let's fill the ranks as much as we can with the army, and they've been trained to do this for 30 years or 50 years. So and that would be my one. If I had a Trump call out, that would be my one.
So but it's just a huge wealth transfer, wealth extraction scheme here. It's just. Plundering it's the plundering of humanity. That's what's going on there.
Yeah. And anytime you get any kind of gross overbilling, you're going to have. And that's what everyone, it's so difficult for people, do you want good college education? Of course I want good college education. Well, we're going to increase the price 30%. We're going to take 25 for ourselves and we're going to give the professors 5. But if you vote against it, you're voting against education.
I always say, someone says you can't put a price on a good education. That's funny. They do.
Quite
no problem
easily.
Putting a price on it with interest. That's a whole nother. Yeah, that's a whole nother predatory lending. I mean, you talk about micro lending. Awful that is, and I think there's a similar scheme with student loans. If you burden someone with debt, you can control them. Burden someone with debt, the third world, you can turn them into sex slaves, and make it appear to be voluntary because their options are so narrow. You've made them desperate. The same thing you can do with a whole. Class of, a whole generation of kids, young adults who are saddled with debt coming out of college and don't have any good job prospects. They're not going to form families, and they're going to work for much less, and they're not going to have leisure time to think or develop any real human capital, intellectual skills, and that's the type of dumbed down masses that the elite perhaps want. You know.
Well, I think social justice videos. I think, you know, be a barista by day and then, you know, do social justice videos on the weekend, and that's. You know, you can make a video about Haiti, about how great it is in Haiti, and Sean Penn, and, you know, do a couple of cut-ins of Beyonce and Jay-Z, and then you're good to go, and then have a latte.
Yeah.
but if you talk to the people actually on the ground, it's a very different story. And I think this generation, you know, we're talking about millennials now, all of a sudden the curtain, you know, Toto pulls a curtain back. At some point in the process here, they were all Bernie. But then I think the Podesta emails, you know, really uncovered this whole, you know, just deception and back dealing and all this subterfuge. And something happened with the millennials that said, I'm not buying the social justice film anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm digging. And I think there's that really has changed with Trump. You know, now Trump, I think, has this whole nother set of challenges, but at least, you know, I was in my conversation with Seymour Hersh today. He said he, to his credit, eliminated two generations of political machines, the Bushes and the Clintons.
Yeah. The two you principal political crime families who were always in partnership. That's a whole other thing. The Bush-Clinton partnership reveals the true nature of the, I think, of the political system, this false left-right Republican-Democrat paradigm that we live under, because they work in tandem. It's a, you know.
And it goes back to that teeter-totter that I was saying before. If the Bushes are in power, we get 60% of the take or 70%, and you get 30. I think it's more like 60-40. If you're in power, you get 60, we get 40. So there still is a fun competitiveness to winning the presidency.
Yeah. I mean, it's competitive within the arena. As long as you're playing within their arena, they'll allow a certain amount of blood sport competitiveness. But really, you can't get out of that arena. You got to be part of the gladiator games. That's played by their rules.
And that's why that's why you saw the Jeb Bushes and the George Bushes and so forth going against Trump, because it was like, hey, wait a minute, this is where we might get zero. You know, and before they had both sides of the table covered. And I would say 60-40 is probably the right split. So they didn't have too many big arguments, but every once in a while they had the Valerie Plame argument. You know, they'd out somebody on the other side and, you know, say something nasty. Joe Wilson would say, you don't have weapons of mass destruction, you know,
But
that was kind of mild stuff, you know.
Yeah, it was a tempest in a teapot, it really was, if you look at the bigger picture, which I think you've exposed with this video series. I mean, it's very easy to be overwhelmed by it all, but you've laid it out well. And the bigger picture, looking at a very sinister business model that I think has been around for centuries, I'm thinking the British East India Company, perhaps. And I'm thinking, what was it, that character, Jeremy Bentham, who wrote an essay in defense of pederasty and also one in defense of usury. And there might be a connection between the two. So,
well, I definitely think very much so. I mean, now we're getting philosophical,
yes.
But you're right on the deal, because if you go back to the original Skull and Bones, and I know everybody at Yale hates me when I say this, it really was this, we're all going to get arrested here because we're running, we're American opium runners that are competing against the British opium runners, and we're undercutting them because we sail better. This is where the America's Cup kind of comes in.
You know, and the Clipper ships. Yeah.
And, you know, it all goes back to this, collapsing a civilization in order to get the drug revenue.
Just because you want
the teachers,
right?
With opium.
You want the porcelain, you want the tea, and you don't want to part with your gold and silver. So let's just destroy the society with opium.
Yeah. There was the Chinese government finally said, look, the opium wars and so forth, we're not going to give any more of our gold. We've almost lost all of our gold to you because of this opium trade, and that's the opium wars. And if you look at that business model of just you know, I call it the straw, you know, just take the straw and just suck everything out that you can until it's a complete corpse. You know, there's nothing left, and then move on to another country.
Yeah.
You know, that whole exploitative model and the stuff you're talking about, Jeremy Bentham, and all that stuff, these kind of like, essays in Time saying, what are we doing? You know, what are we doing?
And it's, I mean, if you look at the whole banking system where you have the, debt-based fiat currency, that is a method for wealth extraction.
Mm-hmm.
Money, it's no longer a store of value, nor is it reliable. It literally is a debt mechanism because every dollar that's put in the economy is backed by debt, which ultimately people have to pay interest on. And that is wealth extraction. It's a compounded interest that ultimately collapses everything. And maybe that's part of the plan. They want to, you know, collapse, you know, make you loan people money, which they create a thin air, then secure the collateral.
You know, when you start talking about finance, sometimes people glaze over. And so what I always try to do is come up with a story that kind of is apocryphal. And Gaddafi is interesting because Gaddafi is kind of like the replacement Saddam Hussein. He's the illegal oil trader that the Bushes are going to use as a replacement for Gaddafi, right? Or for Saddam. And he accumulates, he's making $40 billion a year in oil trade, and he's putting it all in HSBC. And it's piling up. And now people are saying, hey, we're going to topple you, or we don't like you. And he's like, I got nothing. I got a bank statement from HSBC that says $250 billion. But that's not really $250 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So, because they could take it and seize it at any time. So he has somebody whispering in his ear saying, convert it to gold. Convert it to gold. Gold is always negotiable. And then bring it into Africa and create this Africa gold-backed money. So we're going to have an Afro dollar, okay? Or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
An Afro franc or Afro Europe. So there's, you know, this is the whole Mossad. You know, I have a little bit of connections to the Israeli thing, but this is Israeli folklore now. But you convince Gaddafi to bring in like $100 to $150 billion in gold, and you have it stored all around Africa, most of it being in Tripoli. Then you topple them, because when you topple, you get the gold, and there's no transaction, there's no shell corporation. All you need is guys with trucks, you know, like with Saddam. The same thing happened with Saddam, is convince them to put it in the gold. Then you topple them, because then it's just all trucked away, and there's no audit trail. So anyway, this is the working theory that I have, and a lot of other people do, that they were trying, the whole Gaddafi gold-backed currency thing was just to get him to create the central bank with a whole bunch of gold. There's even emails between Sid Blumenthal and Hillary where he says, we've identified $9 billion of the gold, but he can't find the rest of it. And there's this kind of mad scramble. Where's the gold? Where's Gaddafi's gold?
And you have like different intelligence services trying to locate it?
Yeah. So the thought is maybe they're working with Sarkozy. Hillary's working with Sarkozy and French intelligence, maybe British intelligence, and they're all trying to figure out where the gold is. Still could be out there. It might all be in, you know, Malta. We don't know. It's one of the kind of interesting mysteries to the Libya topple. It's kind of a fun side story to the topple.
Well, again, it just all that trouble in Libya 5-6 years ago, Resolution 1973, responsibility to protect, all that BS, it's just a looting operation. They don't care what type of – in fact, they want to create the mayhem and misery, because that serves another part of the plan, perhaps the weakening of Europe, this migration crisis. This can, you know, weaken the euro and prop up the dollar. This can do all types of things. If you're a currency speculator like a George Soros or something, if you have plans to weaken, you know, certain states,
Israelis, Israelis have had plans for that, the Udalyan plan, the microstate plan, which Brzezinski has also endorsed. And, Brzezinski's more of an Atlanticist rather than a Zionist. He's not a Zionist. He's more of a realist, I guess, technocrat. But all types of agendas can be pursued under this stand. But the bottom line is you have these, self-appointed princes infesting palaces, planning wars, and it's the little guy that suffers. I think it was H.L. Mencken that said that war isn't made by the little guy scratching out a living in the fields. Wars are created by princes infesting palaces, and that's what we have here.
Yeah, that's good. I like that, H.L. Mencken. Well, one of the interesting things about Libya, and this gets back to the Valerie Plame thing. One of the things you have to do in NATO is to get all the air power guys, the air generals, the air force generals, to agree that your plan is the way to go. Because if you're going to do a covert operation, you need that air power, because you got these, General Grange has these the guys in the Benghazi movie, they have these Delta Force guys that can have these laser sights. But if they laser sight some colonel's window, you need to have a jet come in, a Mirage jet or an English jet or an Italian jet, to hit that target. So you need to set this thing up years in advance with these NATO guys. And the NATO general that ran that campaign was from Canada. His name is Bouchard. And you're going to find he's running the F-35 campaign right now, which was another plan to get, consensus and agreement on Lockheed and so forth. But anyway, Valerie Plame, when she's running the, let's call it the NATO party circuit, she's bringing all these people in and compromising all these generals 20 years ago. So she really is, I've read her book, Fair Game. She, every other sentence is bleeped, because it gives away, state secret. But she really was the Mata Hari of NATO, and she hasn't gotten appropriate credit because of the whole WMD thing that happens 10 years later. But anyway, Bouchard goes on to NORAD in Colorado, the whole in the mountain thing and withstand nuclear attack and that. And that's kind of like a CIA, the CIA moved from Washington, D.C. out to Denver, and they built the big Denver airport, and then underneath is this huge CIA complex, So the CIA has always kind of had this Dr. Strangelovian thing about mine shafts and, 10 women to every man, and we're going to survive, that whole thing.
Kubrick was revelatory with that. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole Kubrick thing, and
the women would have to be extremely attractive to offer procreation. Course, the one we would have to do away with the monogamous relationship, and all the generals go, oh, that'd be a shame.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Russian bastard goes, I find your plan very interesting.
Yeah, I can't remember the Russian guy's name, but these Harvard papers, these Harvard think pieces that Henry Kissinger did as a young man are finding life, I mean, the whole Denver airport and the whole complex out there and the whole the mine shaft and the underground thing, it all came to life right out of that Peter Sellers wheelchair scene, and so all these programs that are being developed at the University of Denver right now for these kind of sexual entrapment, with all the cameras, these brownstone operations in the U.S., has kind of come down from the elite down to the kind of the local level.
Yeah,
with local police forces and state police forces. So we're going to get our governor, and now we'll get the mayor, and now we'll get Joe Schmo down the street. And this kind of we versus they, thinking, with the fusion centers and so forth. And so all this stuff that's developed overseas with the CIA and so forth just has this weird blowback. It just always ends up coming back to the FBI and getting, kind of inserted in our daily life here.
That's right. Because go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Go ahead.
Oh, because if you look at DHS and the fusion centers, the prototype for that was the Phoenix operation in Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, and the guy who ran the Phoenix operation, one of the key guys was David Grange, the same guy who toppled Libya.
Wow.
And he was running Delta Force and doing all this stuff. And of course, the CIA was, you know, that was their baby, you know, about counterinsurgency. And the only real innovation that's happened since then was David Petraeus, which was the coin counterinsurgency, which is basically kidnapping instead of, you know, and torture versus just, you know, night operations where you just kill everybody. And,
yeah.
You know, and playing one triad against the other is the only innovation really that's happened in, you know, since 1973.
Yeah.
Or this goes back to 1965. So, yeah, I look at Haiti and I say, oh my God, is this that one Kissinger paper where I thought he was on, you know, mescaline, where he talked about depopulation? And are we doing that one too? You know, I mean, I couldn't believe that we did the Denver thing with the mine shafts. Are we going to do the depopulation in Haiti? And it seems like Hillary is. I'm talking about the depopulation paper.
National Security Study Memorandum 200, 1974, I think.
Yeah.
You basically reversed whatever developments occurring in the third world with, use food, energy, and debt as a weapon, and it's weaponized. And that's, well, of course, that's what that was aided greatly by the 73 war, which some people think Kissinger fomented, a decision taking at Bilderberg. That's Bill Engdahl's thesis, which is rather compelling.
Engdahl? Yeah. So Engdahl's always right. That's the first rule. And Engdahl is kind of like, Kissinger's, you know, those puppets, the guys, the puppeteers, where the puppet's always saying the nasty thing.
Yeah.
You know, Engdahl is Kissinger's nasty puppet. That's not right, Henry. You started that.
Yeah.
I mean, no war. I mean, the only one, I mean, I think that maybe you could argue over is 67. But the whole secret pipeline, the whole secret oil pipeline was a Mark Rich, you know, Henry Kissinger thing. And the whole, you know, buying the embargoed Iranian oil and bringing it through and selling it in on the European spot market, that whole thing, and the same thing with the South African oil, that was all Mark Rich and Henry Kissinger. And I'm, like I say, I'm not a citizen of Israel, but I wanted my two kids to serve in the IDF, and I'm pretty Israeli, but I got to say the truth. You know,
yeah.
Which is that was the truth.
Well,
you know,
these embargoes. It's the same like prohibition. It's an excuse to allow for a few people to profit off the embargo. Same way that drug prohibition enables a few select cartels and intelligence agencies and banks, particularly Wall Street and HSBC and Wells Fargo, to profit off all the money that's raised through the illegal arms trade. But the illegal drug trade, because all the profits have to go somewhere, and they go into Wall Street, they go into the banks, and they provide much needed liquidity into the banking system, which then they can through the fractional reserve bank system, you know, multiply 10 to 1 with their loans, with more debt. So
I'll boil all that down. And your command of this is far beyond mine. But there's an old Jewish joke that says, what do Jewish kids do on Christmas morning? They all go down to their dad's toy store and look at the empty shelves. And I know this, I'm a Zionist, come on, so don't get on me. But here's the Jewish joke. It's embargo plus 25%. So, you know, we love the word embargo plus 25%. And Mark Rich would laugh at that. If I was sitting here with Mark Rich, he would laugh at that. And nobody believes more in the Jewish state than I do and make the desert bloom. But you know what? If you have a secret pipeline going through Beersheba, it makes the desert bloom a lot faster, and you can build a lot more fountains at Ben-Gurion University. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say, you know, that we didn't have our hand in a few honeypots. So, you know, embargo plus 25%. We mm-hmm. love embargo. You know, yeah. It's kind of like saying a sale. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, listen, anything else you want, any other thing you want to touch on? Did we cover it well enough, do you think? Or
I do. I think we had a fun chat, and Tim, it was great. You know, it's great bringing up a subject and then having somebody who can go, you know, so much deeper and so fun. And your listeners are so lucky to have you as a host, because you're just so well, you know, so well educated on all these topics.
Well, thank you. That's very, very nice of you to say. Your work is, what you've done, this is fascinating. It's overwhelming. And that's why when I did this interview, I didn't quite know how to handle it, because it's so vast. It's such a big topic. It covers so many, I think, dimensions into the modern world, and why the world is so messed up today. So it's hard, you know, I didn't know where it was going to go. Again, I think, it all goes back to this idea of harvesting humanity. And that seems to be an ideology or a way of looking at things that's been around for at least 500 years, you know.
Well, and I would say to the flip side, is my this open media research is a way of calling all that out. It's a mm-hmm. way of it's Diogenes' lamp. It's a way of just bringing in the sunshine, bringing in the light. And as Hillary said, sunlight's the best disinfectant. And this, if you can go to the site and even contribute one citation or one source, it adds to this cumulative effect, and you just can't get away with it anymore. Mm-hmm. What CNN is hoping you do is look at it as a fireworks show and then go home and then say, "Well, I really didn't learn anything." And what I try to do is build on the day before, so that you really have a sense of understanding and a sense of hope to be able to contribute to kind of end the game, you mm-hmm. know, to put this game to an end.
Because we're stuck in a loop. It's sort of a bloody dialectic here, and that's got to stop at some point. Because where does it end? You mentioned is there a website that you direct people to go to if they're interested in this? Other than
if you just want to go to George Webb on YouTube, I think it'll come up. Or George Webb. The series, I've changed it since Braverman's now at the Google Foundation. I've changed it to Braverman, Haiti, and me. Sort of based on the Michael Moore, Roger and Me.
Oh,
where
yeah.
He kind of
yeah,
followed
yeah.
him all around until he got an answer. Yeah. So that's the new series title. So if you say George Webb and Braverman, you'll see the channel.
Great. Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you for spending so much time with me this evening. It was great. It's fascinating, disturbing, all that. It's just the
all at once.
It's a bit. Yeah. What? So is history. It's all it's very, unfortunately, it's all very interesting, as they say. So it's too interesting.
Yeah.
So, well, great. Listen, thank you. And I'll wish you good night, and good luck with your continuing research. I'll follow it. Thank you.